Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we look into the source of the darkest evil known, the evil nature of mankind. The Algonquin-speaking Cree nation call it Wetiko. In the book, Dispelling Wetiko, Breaking the Curse of Evil, author Paul Levy took on the massive task in untangling the processes of how an unseen, untraceable spiritual virus has infected minds and souls of humans. There are multiple references of Wetiko throughout indigenous culture, Jungian analysis, and the wisdom traditions. Dr. Carl Jung's psychological theory of the human shadow runs parallel in many instances when learning about how Wetiko works through our unconscious state as individuals and collectively. Levy has also gone into great depth in describing the many facets of Wetiko's influence and how it targets those who ignore this ancient psycho-spiritual disease of the soul. By realizing that we're all capable of terrible evil, unwittingly or not, is a beginning to dissolve its strength. Our guest, Paul Levy, was born in Yonkers, New York, and attended the State University of New York in Binghamton in economics and studio art. He was later hired by Princeton University to do economic research. After graduating, he moved to San Francisco to pursue a career in art. In 1981, because of an intense personal trauma suffered a few years earlier, Paul had a life-changing spiritual awakening and began to recognize the dreamlike nature of reality. Paul Levy is also the author of The Madness of George W. Bush, A Reflection of Our Collective Psychosis, and also Awakened by Darkness, When Evil Becomes Your Father. His website is awakeninthedream.com. Paul Levy, welcome to Another News.
Hi, yeah, I'm so happy to be here, so I want to thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, Paul, what are some examples of Wetiko affecting human behavior on a collective and individual level so listeners get a sense of what kind of human misdeeds and shadow craft you're referencing?
Oh, well, I mean, the thing about Wetiko, it's a multidimensional phenomena, which means it informs both our personal process inside of our own minds, our interpersonal relationships, and it's informing the collective body politic as well through what's playing out on the world stage. So basically, you know, it's informing all of the, you know, you could say, you know, whatever, if you want to talk about evil, you could say it's informing all the evil, and I'm not just talking personal evil, but more archetypal evil. And, you know, I actually choose that word on purpose, but it's really, I'm pointing at that, it's actually this impersonal archetypal energy that if it's not consciously seen and integrated, it gets expressed in a destructive way, whether it's self or other destructively. And like I was saying, whether it's inside of our own selves, between people, or on, you know, just collectively as a species.
What made you write a book on the source of darkest evil?
Yeah, well, I never would have imagined writing a book like this when I was younger, growing up. It wasn't something I was interested in. But then just because of what played out in my own life, that in my own family, it actually happened to be my father who unwittingly became kind of an instrument for archetypal evil, not just, I mean, it was his own personal shadow, but that was, he was just more an instrument for the deeper archetype of evil to come through, and it totally destroyed my entire family. I have no family left, and it almost drove me crazy. I mean, it did drive me crazy. It didn't almost drive me crazy. It did drive me crazy, which is not a bad thing. And I'm happy to talk about that, but it almost killed me. And like I said, it consumed my family. I have no family left at all. So, you know, it was as if all of a sudden there was something on my plate that I had to come to terms with. And I chose to deal with it. And it completely changed the trajectory of my whole life. And then after so many years, 30-something years of contemplating it and dreaming about it and studying it and meditating and going to therapy and being an artist and creating art and all this stuff, I actually had the realization, oh, I've kind of discovered something that all the wisdom traditions were pointing at that I could, and that's when I wrote my book, Dispelling Watiko, because I had the realization that it would be really helpful for other people, because we're all dealing with it, whether we know it or not. And so that's why I wrote the book.
And your recent book, is that specifically about your experience living in the family and what your father had done?
Yeah. Like, so basically, when I wrote the Watiko book, it's about the Watiko virus, which is an indigenous term, you know, which is pointing at, you know, this spirit of evil that's informing things. And but the one thing it didn't have was personal experience. And so I decided to write a companion volume to Dispelling Watiko. And it's all about how I was authorized, you know, to author a book on the deepest, darkest evil imaginable. So I told my story. And I told my story about my relationship with my father, who was just a very, you know, he was just a very sick guy. I didn't have the context for it. I understand now, yeah, he just was so taken over by his unconscious that he unwittingly became a conduit for what's called the Watiko virus, or, you know, the Watiko spirit, to come through him and enter the petri dish of our family. And so that's one of the stories I tell, and I really go into that, you know, but not blaming or playing a victim, but really pointing out, oh, that him playing that role, it was showing me, it was like kind of like an embodied form. He was this revelation of the Watiko virus, which is a formless entity, but here it was taking human form. But the other part of the story is then once I had my whole spiritual awakening that got catalyzed because of the depth of the suffering that I was in based on the abuse from my father, then I got into the clutches of psychiatry, and they write it. And, you know, I'm talking in the early 80s, and they right away, I mean, what they do, they just pathologize you, and they diagnosed me and medicated me, and it was such a nightmare because they had no idea what was happening. They didn't see the spiritual awakening part. They protected my father. The abuse was invisible to them. They gave me a wrong diagnosis and medicated me and guaranteed that I'd have a mental illness for the rest of my life and that I would need medication. I can understand now. It was part of the awakening. It was the descent into Hades. But I was really fortunate to be able to get through that. And what enabled me to get through that was I knew in my own mind, it could not have been more obvious that I was having a spiritual awakening. So this recent book I just came out with is really telling my story about my father, psychiatry, as a way of really trying to show how the Watiko virus, it's a field phenomena, so it works through the non-local field. It doesn't just operate in one person. But it also showed me that encoded in the evil, it's actually helping us. It's actually a gift if we're able to have the recognition of what it's showing us, and it can help us to wake up.
Was a spiritual awakening similar to what a lot of people talk about, and they call it the Kundalini?
Yeah, no, it definitely. Mine was, you know, my Kundalini just completely got activated, I mean, you know, right within the first day. And, yeah, so it's a similar thing.
I got you. Okay.
But it's a very dangerous situation because one of the metaphors that I use, I say to people, it was like I was a light bulb, and I went from being a 75-watt light bulb to being like a quadrillion watts, and it almost fried my circuits. It almost completely killed me.
I guess it's now a popular conversation with Carlos Castaneda and Don Juan, a Mexican Yaqui Indian shaman.
Mm-hmm.
And Don describes a predator among us. Some might call it a parasite, but it's a look at an ancient invader that has given us its mind. Can you talk about this predator among us that Carlos Castaneda and Don Juan are referencing?
Yeah, and that, you know, what, and you know, it's come out. It seems fairly certain that the Castaneda books were kind of, you know, that they were not nonfiction, but they were a fictionalized version, which is fine. From my point of view, that even makes them more profound because it taps into the shamanic art of storytelling and the literary imagination, how that is like a shamanic journey. So that doesn't take anything away from his whole body of work, the fact that it might actually be made up. It actually, like I said, makes it more profound in a way. And so, yeah, he has Don Juan, his teacher, talk about this predator. and this parasite. And, you know, as he's describing the scenario, it's word for word what I write about in my book. And I point that out in my book. And the idea being, if I can just really unfold this, is that in the ultimate sense, because I don't want to create any fear, because Watiko, it feeds off of and into fear. So I don't want to create fear in the listener. The ultimate sense, there is no such thing as Watiko. It doesn't actually exist. It has no intrinsic independent existence, like Buddhism would say. It's totally empty. And yet, it can destroy our species. So that's very interesting, that paradox, that something that doesn't even have any intrinsic existence can destroy our species. And that's pointing at something. It's pointing at that we have this invisible, untapped power within our own mind, that to the extent we're unconscious of it, there's an energy that actually taps into that unconscious energy in us and turns it against ourselves. So the point being that ultimately there's no such thing as this predator or Watiko, but yet from the point of view of this being a relative reality, our subjective experience is such that we experience the scenario as if there's a predator, as if it actually exists. And that needs to be honored. That's the relative level of reality, and we need to come to terms with that. We can't just identify with the absolute point of view and say, oh, it doesn't exist, there's no such thing, because by doing that, if we're not dealing with actual the relative level of its manifestation, then it'll destroy us. Because in any wisdom tradition, they talk about that the relative level and the absolute level are not separate, they interpenetrate. And you can't just ignore one and identify with the other. So, you know, what I'm trying to say with a lot of words, basically, is that, yeah, what Castaneda has Don Juan saying is exactly the same thing. And it's as if there is some sort of energy, to the extent we don't have relationship to it and we're not aware of it, it can, behind the scenes of our unconsciousness, in a sense, sit in our seat and take over our mind. And if I can just describe that really succinctly, because the thing about Watiko, it's a shape-shifting bug, and so it assumes our form. It'll impersonate us. It puts us on. And putting us on has a double meaning, like putting on a suit of clothes, but also when it puts us on is to fool us. So it impersonates us through a particular thought form or a belief or on, you know, an identity. And if we're not aware that it's like actually aping us at that moment, we'll identify with its particular position, with that particular identity pattern, with that thought, with that belief, we'll act out that impulse, all the while we're thinking it's us who's doing it, but unwittingly we have then, based on our unconsciousness, because it acts out through our blind spots, we unwittingly have become its instrument for it to incarnate in the world through us. And so this whole process, I mean, this is what my book is about. I just describe this in great detail, how to actually see that. And of course, it doesn't want us to see it, because when we see it, then it's out of business. Then it can't act itself out in an you know, autonomous, omnipotent way through us.
Now, Don Juan is an Indian shaman, and it makes sense that he would notice something intrinsically lethal lurking in the subtle realm. Because you write that in the mythic context, a Watiko can't be killed by anything short of a silver bullet or magic ritual performed by an accomplished shaman. In a past interview analyzing the archetypal nature of the evil clown with Lori Shapira with the C.G. Jung Institute in New York, Lori referenced how the lack of a shaman in a society could yield the manifestation of the evil clown within the culture. What are your thoughts on the importance of shamanic work and Watiko?
Yeah, well, it's crucial. And how I came to my own shamanic work, I mean, I knew nothing about shamanism, as you know, when I actually had my whole awakening and all that. I was in my mid-20s. And then, but pretty quick, I figured out, oh, I had gotten enlisted into this deeper shamanic process. And, you know, in the archetypal shamanic process, it almost always gets catalyzed by some form of emotional disturbance, you know, some form of unhealed trauma or abuse or wounding. And that was definitely true for me. So then what happens, we split. We sort of have this disassociation to the extent that we have an unintegrated unconscious part, and that activates the shamanic archetype where we go in search, we go on the journey to try to find and to remember our lost member, the lost parts of ourselves. And so it's a very archetypal, you know, process in that the person who's called, you know, keep in mind it's never something one would do just, you know, out of one's own conscious, you know, will, or, oh, I'm going to go to shaman graduate school or take a shamanic workshop and become a certified shaman. It's not like that at all. That's not the way it works. When you connect with the shamanic call, you know, the shamanic archetype, it's something that the spirits call you. And so the idea is that there's some sort of deeper process. And then typically what happens, you invariably have to make a descent into the underworld, into the underworld of the unconscious, the place of shadow, which is where you encounter, you know, these things that indigenous people call, like, you know, they would say demons or madness or death, all of stuff like that. You really have to come to terms with that. And if you're able to not get stuck in that lower realm, in the hell realms, and actually be able to come back, you know, it's said that typically the shaman, they have some sort of gift for the community through their ordeal, and they themselves are changed and transformed. And the whole, you know, I've written a lot about this, I write about this in the book, is that we as a species, we're going through an initiative, like a shamanic initiatory process, which is like this death process of having a rebirth. It's always a death rebirth. You know, so the point is that we're all shamans in training, but the key thing about the shamanic archetype is when you're being called, when it's calling you, if you resist it and say, no, I can't do that, it's not convenient, I'm not good enough, or whatever story you tell yourself, that's when the would-be shaman gets really sick and can even die and can go totally mad. But the key thing is to assent, to say, okay, I'm going to cooperate with this deeper calling. And then what happens is that the spirit that's calling you, you've actually, by cooperating with it, it's the very sponsor not only of the calling, but it'll send you then everything you need. But what it needs from you is to assent to it, is to agree and say, okay, I will cooperate and consciously follow this process.
That's really fascinating, and I'm seeing the similarities to the shadow aspect. Can Watiko be masked by good intentions, such as the overprotective government, creating a surveillance state, those types of things?
Oh, totally. Well, Watiko, it almost always will mask itself through good intentions. And so on the surface, it can appear really, it's this benign thing with the best of intentions. It's all for our own good. And but if we subscribe to it without awareness of what's actually happening, it's like then we're actually complicit in feeding this deeper evil in a way that's actually contrary to our own best interests. So you see, the thing about Watiko, it operates through, like I was saying, the unconscious, sort of these blind spots that are in the psyche, in such a way, so it operates through the projective tendencies of the mind, because we're always projecting, and but it operates through the projective tendencies of the mind, through the blind spot, in such a way that we then unwittingly become the instrument to act it out, and at the same time, it hides itself from being seen. And so, you know, as long as we're asleep to this, and it also will kind of piggyback on us through our unprocessed shadow. With the shadow, there's both the personal dimension and the archetypal dimension, but it's almost like the personal dimension becomes an open channel for the Watiko virus to, in a sense, to come into us. And then, you know, but deep down, when you go down deep enough, that interfaces to the archetypal shadow, which isn't a personal thing. That's more of an impersonal energy. And, you know, and then I've written all about how it works out. The one way of understanding the Watiko bug is through shadow projection. It projects the shadow outside of itself, you know, and then as soon as it does that onto some other person or a group of people, and then invariably evoke the very shadow quality it's projecting to appear outside of itself through some form of other, and then it has all the evidence it needs that, oh, the evil, it really is out there, so it becomes even more entrenched that the evil is outside of itself. And then, of course, it tries to destroy the evil outside of itself because that's a reflection of the initial process of trying to destroy the evil within itself that it can't deal with. But by doing that, it literally becomes the person who's taken over. It literally becomes possessed by the very evil they're trying to destroy. And you know, that's a psychological description of how Watiko operates through the psyche.
I'm really amazed at how this overlaps with Carl Jung's theories. On the show, we've done several interviews focusing directly on Dr. Carl Jung's psychological theory of the shadow within the human personality. And Dr. Connie Zweig, one of the authors of the anthology titled Meeting the Shadow, she works with clients, and on her site it says, quote, to detect unconscious sources of secret feelings and behaviors, rage, jealousy, lying, resentment, blame, inferiority, power struggle, addiction, procrastination, that erupt in destructive ways. And she can help you to find the gold that lies hidden there, the deeper need beneath these difficult feelings and behaviors that you can meet in more positive ways. Now, what areas do Carl Jung's theories on the shadow overlap and differ with Watiko virus?
Oh, well, I would say they don't differ at all. You know, I mean, I've been studying his work for decades, and it's greatly informed my own work. And yeah, no, he was completely onto Watiko. He didn't have the name for it. He calls it, you know, a different name. And I point that out in my book. And so, yeah, no, it totally, you know, it is complemented by Jung's work on the shadow. And, you know, if I could just say something about that, that the idea, like, he really brought in, like, the alchemical opus, that he had the realization that, oh, the alchemists, they were really what they were doing. It was a symbolic kind of operation that was really, it was so much a reflection of what happens in the psyche. And if you think about alchemy, like you had mentioned, in, you know, the fact that hidden in the, what's called the prima materia, the rejected, despised stuff of the psyche, the real, like, shit, so to speak, and hidden in that, hidden in the darkness, is the gold. And so instead of the prima materia, like, oh, you know, for years, I had been wounded and traumatized and abused by my father. And for years, I was like, oh, if only this hadn't happened for me, then I would be okay. Then I would be, you know, enlightened or whatever my story was. But then as I matured, I understood, oh, no, it's actually, it was through my wounding, encoded in the wounding, there was the gold, and there's the blessing. So you actually have to, in a sense, alchemically discover and transmute what seems to be the darkness, you know, not just personal shadow, but archetypal shadow. You have to transmute that into the gold, which is the enlightenment. And so that's why I just, you know, really quickly, I had mentioned before that the thing about Watiko, you see, it's a quantum phenomenon. And what I mean by that is that it has a superposition of states, that it encoded in Watiko is both the darkest evil that our species can play out, you can even imagine, and it's the greatest blessing, and it's all encoded in one phenomena. And similar, when I say quantum, I mean, think about light. Well, is light a wave or a particle? Well, it depends how it's observed. Same thing with Watiko. If we don't have the recognition of what it's showing us, then guaranteed we're going to continue to act it out, both self and other, destructively. But if we have the recognition of what it's revealing to us, then all of a sudden we begin to get the blessing. And the blessing is to see the dreamlike nature of reality. And that's to begin to wake up. And we wouldn't have been able to do that without Watiko. So that brings up the deeper question of, oh, is Watiko evil or is it actually good? And you begin to realize, you know, the opposites more and more as you wake up to what Watiko is showing us. You know, in alchemy, they talk about the coincidentia oppositorum, the coincidence of opposites. And so the opposites become indistinguishable. And that's, of course, a symbol of the philosopher's stone, of the lapis, of the gold, of the enlightened mind. And the amazing thing is that we wouldn't have gotten to that place without Watiko.
I love the parallel here. It's great. How would you suggest to someone listening right now ways in which they could recognize the Watiko influence or manifestation in their life?
Well, I mean, there are three ways. There are probably a lot more than three, but there are three that I kind of talk about. And they're all the same in a way. They're all aspects of the same deeper, you know, sort of energy. And because I think about in my life when what was happening with in my family. So here my father, to give an example, was, you know, was a very sick man and was playing out this, you know, he was acting out his unconscious and just playing out his stuff and just acting that without any consciousness. And I was in the role of the one who was not only the recipient of it, but had some form of awareness and was trying to point at it or shed light on it. And what I couldn't believe was how the entire family system, not only my mother, but the relatives, but then once mental health psychiatrists came in, they played this role too, that the whole field, the whole family system actually configured to protect the abuser. And, you know, and I didn't realize at the time because I was so young, but this is typical. Like, I became the identified patient, you know, which means I was the one in the family system who was seen to be the sick one. But it was like the whole field, like I was saying, configured to protect the abuser. And that's when I began to realize, oh, my God, there's like a higher dimensional process that's informing what's playing out. It was, in physics, they talk about the field is this non-local energy. It doesn't play by the rules of third-dimensional space and time. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, of those three, the first one is seeing the field. When you begin to realize, oh, wow, actually everything that's happening there, it's all like, you know, interconnected in a certain way, that it's not separate and that it's contained within and expressions of this deeper non-local field. And so that would be the first way of seeing it. But going along with that is then you begin to realize, oh, well, once I see the field, that makes me realize that we're actually not separate from each other, that I'm not separate from you and I'm interconnected and interdependent with you, and that you actually don't exist as an isolated, independent entity either, but you exist, you have relationship to other beings who are also, who don't have a fixed reference point, and we're all interconnected and interdependent. That's the snap out of the spell of the separate self, and that's to realize, wow, we're all actually interconnected and interdependent. And the expression of that is compassion. So that's the second of the three aspects. And the third, which goes along with number one and two, is to see the dreamlike nature of reality, that this is, you know, I just finished a book on quantum physics, and I talk about that. What quantum physics is pointing at is that there's no objective reality, but on the contrary, the act of observing the reality actually changes the reality we're observing, i.e. the observer is the observed. What I've just described, that's exactly the nature of a dream. You know, when you're in a dream, if you change your perception, the dream instantaneously shapeshifts to reflect back our change in perception, because the dream is nothing other than our own mind appearing to us. That's our nature. That's the nature of our situation right now. So it's those three things, seeing the non-local field, having the realization we're not separate, and seeing the dreamlike nature, that when you actually, you know, are accessing those viewpoints or that realization, that helps you to stabilize and be able to see Watiko. And once you see it, it can't, like a vampire, it can't stand to be seen because it takes away its power.
How long is the process of dissolving Watiko after you reach the point of understanding the dream state nature of reality?
Yeah, well, it never ends. It's an ongoing process. It's not like, oh, somebody sees it, and then if I think, oh, I've seen Watiko, now I can just rest, well, guess what? At that moment, I've fallen under its spell. Because the point is, we all have Watiko in potential. It exists in the collective unconscious of our species. If I say, oh, that person has Watiko, you know, and I don't, well, the bug feeds off of polarization. So by me saying that, then I'm actually unwittingly, with the best of intentions, I'm reinforcing and feeding the very virus that I'm actually trying to heal. So it's important to understand, on the one hand, we all have it, which means at any moment, any of us can fall under its spell. And think about it. Who among us hasn't fallen into their unconscious and acted out their unconscious? We all have. I mean, that's what Christ was saying when he said something like, who can cast the first stone? The idea being that we've all sinned. You know, we've all fallen asleep at given moments. So it's not just like, oh, now I've seen it, and now, I mean, like I'm trying to say, if I feel like now I've seen it, and now I'm, you know, I'm not, you know, I can't fall under its spell anymore, well, guess what? You just have. So the point is to develop that mindfulness, humility, and compassion, and in a sense, that immunizes, you know, and the open heart, the empathic open heart, all of that serves as an inoculation from Watiko.
I was wondering about the use of psychological drugs such as antidepressants and other elements in our society that could suppress the awakening of seeing Watiko.
Well, the thing is this, you know, like, for example, I have a real charge around pharmaceutical drugs, because when I was having my spiritual awakening, which was a full-blown spiritual awakening, you know, I got misdiagnosed. This was in 81, you know, and I was told, oh, you have this chemical imbalance, which, you know, has then come out, you know, decades later. They've confessed, you know, psychiatric big pharma has confessed, oh, that was just completely made up and bogus. You know, the pharmaceutical companies just made that up to sell more drugs, to make more money. So I'm the last person in the world to want anybody to take any sort of pharmaceutical drugs. But that being said, they can be helpful for certain people at certain moments if the suffering is just too intense, and it can help them to really get through hard times.
Right.
But they have incredibly destructive, these long-term effects. It's really about getting people hooked on them so that they become consumers of the drugs for the rest of their lives and spend a ton of money. You know, they don't even know the long-term side effects of a lot of these drugs. You know, I would just counsel people, yeah, you know, it's not like, you know, I'm just saying in this unilateral way, no, they're just bad. No, they can be really helpful, but to use them with real caution, because they can incredibly get in the way of connecting with our deeper awakening. They can create like this anesthesia in the psyche where we become numb to our feelings, and then we're not really able to deal with the deeper emotional process that's informing our being upset.
In chapter 8, titled Evil, you write about some of your readers who objected to the use of the word evil. The word triggered something inside them which made them feel uncomfortable. You ask, is there something being revealed to us because it's a trigger, and do we need the homeopathic dose? Can you talk about that in context of the current criticism within classroom environments and that prevent professors to teach certain topics because of trigger words such as rape?
Yeah, totally. Well, you know, it makes me think, like I had a dream one time, and in the dream I was lucid in the dream to whatever degree I was. So I was going up to my dream characters, you know, who are just aspects of myself, and I was, in my excitement, was telling them, oh, hey, guess what? This is all a dream. We're dreaming. And one of them, I'll never forget this, he was like, you know, could you use another word? I have, like, a charge around that word, and I just have bad associations around the word dream, and could you choose another word? So here I am, and I'm in a dream, and I'm realizing it's a dream, and I'm saying to other people it's a dream, and they're saying, oh, please don't use that word. And it's like a similar conundrum you find. And I talk about this in my latest book, that evil, there's no better word to describe the incredible destruction that's being enacted. Like, that word was coined with a particular meaning. And I totally understand that it's a trigger word. That word like that, somebody hears it and they immediately get triggered. And, you know, what typically people do is, oh, well, just if you don't use that word, then I won't be triggered, then I'll feel better. But I would like to offer to them, well, what in you is being touched in your process of being triggered? What about if you put your attention there and see it as an opportunity to inquire into the charge that just got activated by the mere mention of the word evil, as compared to like, oh, stop mentioning that word and then I won't be triggered. That just seems backwards and upside down. And so I think it's really important. It's a moral need of our species to find the right words for our experience. And it also brings up the fact that in mainstream culture, they can, you know, it's easy for the powers that be to control our perceptions and our thinking by making these limitations on what we're allowed to talk about. Oh, we can't, that can't be part of the dialogue. Oh, we can't use that word. Oh, you can't think about that. Oh, you're not allowed to perceive in that way. And it's all part of the programming, the conditioning, the brainwashing, the hypnosis that we all go through. It's like we're being put under a spell, and the spell is of massive proportions. It's a collective spell, and the, you know, the mainstream media is the major propaganda organ of the powers that be. So the, you know, I just really feel strongly that it's super important for us to find the right word. And that's why even in my book, I talk about the importance of finding the word Wetiko, that I'm not attached to that's the word we use. Every wisdom tradition has their own word for what the natives call Wetiko. But it's important to find a word that has like a meaning to us. And, you know, just one final thing, like in a fairy tale or a myth, if there's like a demon, the, you know, they always point at that once you find the demon's name, and it can't just be any name, it has to be the right name, the proper name. Once you find the right name of the demon, it takes away its power. And the same way, we have this need to be able to like find the language and find the words, and how do you make a word? You spell it, to find the words that actually create the counterspell. That's why, I, you know, the title of my book is Dispelling the Curse of Evil, you know, and so it's super important for us to be able to, you know, to be able to speak the right word for what our experience is.
You talk about the entry point of Wetiko in through the unconscious. What do you talk about in regard to those who are conscious of their Wetiko condition and fine with it? They completely understand it in a conscious state, embrace it, and want others to come aboard. Who are those people?
Yeah, well, those people tend to be artists, and that, in, you know, what I and why I say that is, Wetiko, it's not a personal energy. It's an archetypal impersonal energy. It's what's called this daimonic energy, and the daimon is an interesting word, because a daimon, the daimonic, it's an energy being archetypal that can literally possess a person or a group of people. And so we can possess a person such that they become the instrument to act it out through them. You know, they become the unwitting channel for the daimonic energy to act itself out. But the word daimon etymologically is very interesting, because it means the inner voice, the guiding spirit. It's related to genie, as in I dream of genie, genius, the word genius, also calling, hearing a voice, and vocation. And so the idea is that if we get into relationship, the conscious relationship with the daimon, with the inner voice, with our guiding spirit, we'll find our voice, our calling, our vocation, our genius, and, you know, we'll be able to connect with our power and with ourselves. But if we actually turn away from that daimon, then that daimon constellates in a negative way and becomes a demon. And that's the negative aspect of Wetiko. The point is that people, getting back to your question, people who are actually turned on to the walls of Wetiko and see it, they're able to alchemically transmute that daimonic energy, because, you know, just one final thing about the daimon, encoded in the daimonic energy is the creative energy that's not yet made real. But once you tap into the daimonic energy consciously, you're also tapping into the creative spirit. So that same daimonic energy that, if we're unconscious of, turns destructive, once we add consciousness to it, then it informs the highest creativity. And that's why I started off the answer by saying, oh, it's artists who typically are the ones who do that.
Is there a negative aspect to this with people that are okay with being in the negative part of Wetiko and not getting into the more advanced, evolved version of it, and then they find each other like the psychopaths?
Yeah, well, the thing is, yeah, there's a counter incentive when you see, like, for example, we're all part of, you know, social structure, just our society, our culture. And when you begin to see Wetiko, when you begin to see how it's playing out outside of ourselves, you begin to realize, oh, what up, the evil I'm seeing out there, it's actually a reflection of the evil inside of me, which means that I'm actually colluding and unwittingly complicit in the evil that's playing out in the world. And there's a counter incentive to seeing that, because it's shattering. It induces a form of trauma, because you have to realize, oh my God, I've been out of my mind. I've been in bed with evil. I've been besides myself. I'm colluding with the very darker forces I'm fighting against. You know, so there are people who actually, so many people who just don't have the courage or the willingness or the capability to actually really come full circle and see the reflective nature of the darkness they're seeing outside of themselves and recognize it's their own reflection. And they typically tend to connect with other people like that in this collective form of, like, they're just narcissistically reinforcing each other's asleepness together. And there's almost like an impenetrable bubble that gets conjured up around them. You know, I could use lots of examples politically, you know, whether it's with Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or George W. Bush, the people who are supporters of these people, and they're all in agreement. And any sort of reflection that they might be actually, you know, asleep in a certain way, they see the people holding the mirrors as being the demons, you know, and so they're not able to take any informing influence from the outside world. Yeah, and that, you know, invariably is going to guarantee just over the course of time, their creative spirit just kind of getting smaller and smaller and less potent, to the point where they just, instead of accessing that creative spirit constructively, creatively, in a way that's helping the world and helping themselves, they're actually unwittingly investing in their own genocide. And I talk about this in my book. I mean, that's what our species collectively is doing. We're killing ourselves. That's obvious. Anybody who doesn't see that is just blind. Because think about it, Watiko, another way of saying it, it's a form of blindness. It induces a form of psychic blindness such that we think we're sighted when we have Watiko while we're actually, like, you know, psychically blind.
Yes, on the collective level, it is a profound destruction that we're witnessing right now.
And yeah.
The other side of this with physiological disposition of a psychopath, not even part of this conversation necessarily. They have a physiological, like a hardware issue.
Yeah, well, I mean, I hear that, and I'm all, you know, I don't have a problem with that, except for the fact that I don't want to solidify any, I'm not, you know, just like with psychiatric diagnosis, when somebody says, oh, that person's bipolar, or that person has ADHD, well, actually, there's not even a biological marker. There's not even any discrete psychological illness called, you know, bipolar that we actually, you know, have evidence for. It's just a label for, you know, describing behavior. And the same thing with psychopaths. Yeah, I understand that there are people who are psychopathic, or, you know, however you would describe it. I describe my father as a sociopath who's gone psycho, almost like in a poetic way of trying to, like, get across the flavor of it. But the point is that we all potentially have that psychopath within us to concretize and solidify and to otherize the psychopath out there. You know, well, hey, if you see that and you're reacting out of a real charge, well, guess what? The fact that there's a charge in you, there's some sort of projection that you're seeing in that psychopath. So the point I'm saying is that we all have that in potential. And yeah, it can have a utility to have that name and category for certain people in certain circumstances, but just don't confuse the map with the territory type of thing. Don't, like, just, you know, take your diagnoses as having, like, sort of an ontological, like, reality that it doesn't.
Understood. As you know, there is a large body of work, scientific and medically, put down on the description of psychopathy, and it's directed into the physiological aspects of it. So I was wondering about the software, hardware pieces there.
Yeah, well, if I could just say one thing about that, because, I mean, it's totally tied into Watiko, because it's also a form of trauma. Well, like, think about it. If I'm in trauma, the way I'm trying to heal from my trauma is literally creating the very trauma I'm trying to heal from in a self-perpetuating, infinitely self-generating feedback loop. And that's madness. And that's a form, and that also informs, like, addictions. And that, so when somebody is what we call a psychopath, yeah, they actually have become, in a sense, so identified with a version of themselves that doesn't even exist, i.e. that they exist as an independent, separate self that's not in connection with anybody else. And then that becomes the feedback loop that they're just always protecting and defending and feeding and reinforcing, and then everybody else is otherized, and that's where there's no empathy. And so, yeah, from that point of view, absolutely, what we're calling psychopath or psychopathy, that's just another way of describing, you know, what happens when somebody, because to think about Watiko, there are all these levels of it, but there are people who at a certain point in their life, and maybe their whole life, get completely possessed by Watiko to the point where that's just what's in their driver's seat. And then they're like a shell, and they appear to be a human being, but there's actually the archetypal deeper energy that's informing every moment of their existence. And, yeah, so, you know, from that point of view, I have no problem at all with, you know, all I'm saying is to use caution with that word. It's one of those examples of, we were talking about evil before, or a dream. It's one of those examples of a word that has a real charge.
Oh, it definitely does. There's a really good book written titled Political Ponderology, and it was written...
Yeah, no, I know it, totally.
You know it. Okay. Yeah. Paul, what is the Watiko operation behind the intense, sustained hatred for other people to the point where you would want to slowly build an apparatus of slavery, surveillance, propaganda, and constant perception management prodding? Then under these circumstances, you're punished for not being able to see the bars of your cage, while the goal is total slavery of women and men.
Yeah, well, I mean, I see that stuff, and how, you know, I mean, I might articulate it a little bit differently, but I get what you're saying. And yeah, I've been tracking that for years in the world as it's playing out, as it's getting outpictured in the world. But I would just point out that that's a dreaming process. And what I mean by that is that's a reflection of that's an inner psychological process that's happening inside of us, that's getting, to the extent we're unconscious of it inside of ourselves, guaranteed it's going to get dreamed up and play out in the world. You know, and that's the way the psyche works. When we're unconscious of something, we project it outside of ourselves. But that's actually the process where we're potentially becoming conscious, but that necessitates us having the recognition that what we're seeing outside of ourselves is a reflection of something inside of us. So what I'm trying to say is that all of this incredible, nefarious, insidious, and overt evil that's playing out in the world, you know, in all different dimensions and in all different ways, where there's like trying to centralize power and control and make people slaves or whatever, however you would describe it, that's an actual reflection of how the Watiko bug works in ourselves. You know, that it tries to set up its operation in our psyche and slowly, in a sense, like become the governor of our own, to the point where we then compulsively act it out. We've lost our agency, our creative agency, and that's just getting reflected through the outer body politic. And you know, that's important to see, because when you see that reflection, that the inner is, you know, reflection of that the outer is a reflection of the inner and vice versa, that's when you're beginning to see Watiko. That's when you're beginning to see the non-local field. That's when you're beginning to see the dreamlike nature. And think about it. Christ in the apocryphal text said the same thing. He goes, when you recognize the inner as the outer, that's when you begin to enter the kingdom.
In another realm here, the Watiko virus is also a popular theme within science fiction's basic warning against artificial intelligence. The Terminator, AI, 2001 A Space Odyssey. Would Watiko take hold within an artificial intelligence environment?
Yeah, well, the thing about, and it's funny because a couple of articles that I'm working on, one is Philip K. Dick. He was totally turned on to Watiko. He called it Black Iron, the Black Iron Prison. And also there's a book by Colin Wilson, what is it called? Mind Parasites. The Mind Parasites. So Philip K. Dick and Colin Wilson, I'm writing, and they're both like sci-fi authors who are in a completely fictionalized way are describing Watiko. But to get to the answer to your question, yeah, the thing about Watiko, it disconnects us from our heart, from our sense of being humans, such that we become automatons. We just become conditioned and programmed. So that really feeds into the AI, to the artificial intelligence, that as we forget what it is to be, you know, human beings who are actually have empathy and compassion and care about each other, and are these social creatures whose main, you know, highest value is love and compassion. To the extent we forget about that and we just become, in a sense, conditioned and programmed to, in a sense, feed the state, we do become like these robots, and that totally feeds into, I think, a lot of these sci-fi authors imagine, you know, this world ruled by artificial intelligence, and it's like, you know, it's like a nightmare world, and it's totally a world that's ruled by Watiko.
The work that you do in the workshops with helping people awaken in the dream, can you talk about that process that some of these people go through awakening?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have these groups all throughout the week. You know, I'm in Portland, Oregon, and, you know, three or four nights a week, I have one tonight and tomorrow night and the night after that. And they're for people who are, to whatever degree, they're awakening to the dreamlike nature. They've snapped out of the consensus reality spell, and they're having the realization that we're having a mass shared dream, that we're dream characters in each other's dreams. Yeah, there's just a way of being together and following our process in relationship with each other that can really show the dreaming, that can really help people to, you know, to snap out of whatever their story is or whatever they're holding on to. And the whole idea is that there's something that's available to us as a species when we come together and hang out in a certain way. It's what I call, we can conspire to co-inspire. It's a real conspiracy theory where we can, the collective sort of like genius, we can activate the collective genius of all of us by hanging out and, you know, being together in a certain way. And by just following our process and following the moment. And, you know, it's a little bit hard to describe in words because it's an experiential process.
Okay.
But basically, so I have these groups, you know, that are helping people to, I've been doing this for over 20 years, that are helping people to awaken in the dream. And I'm just wanting to get this out because it can help, it can incredibly help our species. Because there is a way, as long as we're isolated and fragmented and disassociated from each other, that's really challenging. But when we discover, oh, that we're all going through a similar process of awakening and maybe being challenged with our particular issues and shadow stuff, but that we're not separate, but we actually can connect with other people and we can support each other and help each other, then all of a sudden, you know, the powers that be, that's their worst nightmare, is for us to come together and activate the collective genius. And so that's, in a way, what these groups are about. And, you know, I could talk about them for hours. It's my life's work, too. But that's just a little bit, that there's a way of actually just basically hanging out where we can activate, you know, lucidity.
How would listeners get in touch with you if they want to be part of that?
Yeah, well, you know, keep in mind they're not cyber groups. They're only in Portland in my living room. And so they can email me and, you know, they can go to my website, awakenindhedream.com is the website. And then there's a ton of articles. It's all for free. You know, a lot of interviews, video and audio. And then, you know, if you can get my books, that's the one thing I'm selling are my books. There's a way of just sending me an email right from my site. And, you know, but the thing is, I'm not trying to make money with this. I'm just, even though it's what I do for a living, I'm just trying to, this is really helpful information for people. People, you know, reflect back, they get real benefit, not only from the groups, but from the articles and the books and the interviews and stuff. So I just want to get this work out to try to be of help for people.
Yes, the Watiko virus, it's everywhere, nowhere at the same time. It has the potential to destroy humanity, residing in the collective subconscious blind spot, yet we can dissolve it by being self-reflective, aware, and in tune with who we are, meaning conscious of our own evil potential.
Yeah, and conscious of our goodness, too. It's not, but yeah, but definitely people who are just identified with that, they're all good. I mean, they scare me. You know, they're the really dangerous ones, you know, because they're not conscious of the possibility of them falling asleep.
What is the power inherent in a truly self-reflective mind?
Oh, well, you know, the power is that we're co-creators with the universe, and this is just quantum physics, you know, that we're actually moment by moment, whether we know it or not, we're co-creating our experience of ourselves and our experience of the world. But to the extent we're asleep, we're doing that unconsciously in a way that probably isn't serving us. So when you actually add consciousness to that, then you all of a sudden, oh, well, just like a dream that you have lucidity in, I can actually, you know, dream the dream in a way that's in alignment with who I'm discovering myself to be. And that's a radically different situation than just being kind of a passive, you know, sort of victim who's just being blown by the winds of karma and just unconsciously reacting. On the contrary, when you actually connect with who you are, you become like a sovereign, autonomous, you know, person who has agency, who has creative agency to create not only your own experience, but then as an artist to actually step into the dream and create a circumstance that can help other people. And so basically what I'm saying is that you discover that we can actually participate in our own evolution. And that's radical. That's evolutionary. And that's what all of this is about. Like if Watiko didn't exist, we would have to invent it. It's actually helping us, you know, to wake up.
I really love that about the book. Our guest is Paul Levy. The book is titled Dispelling Watiko, Breaking the Curse of Evil. Paul is also the author of The Madness of George W. Bush and Awakened by Darkness. Paul, I want to thank you for being on Another News. It's just powerful material.
Yeah, I want to thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for more information on the guests and archived shows.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Before the fiddlers have fled, before they ask us to pay the bill, and while we still have the chance, let's face the music and dance. Soon we'll be without the moon, humming a different tune, and then there may be teardrops to shed. So while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance.